¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the necessary shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Bulwark contributor and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center. My normal partner in this enterprise, Elliot Cohen, the Robert E. Osgood Professor of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, is off vacationing somewhere in the Iberian Peninsula. Poor Elliot. But we have as our very special guest today, former Supreme Allied Commander General Philip Breedlove. General Breedlove is one of our most distinguished, I would say, military strategists. In addition to having been the Supreme Allied Commander, he was the commander of U.S. Air Forces in Europe. He was the Vice Chief of Staff of the Air Force. I first got to know him when he was the Vice Director of the Strategic Plans Office in the J5 of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I was privileged to have him as my wingman in more meetings of the Deputies Committee during the period from 2006 to 2008 than either he or I would like to remember. He is now a distinguished professor of practice at the Sam Nunn School at Georgia Tech, of which General Breedlove is a proud graduate. General Breedlove, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Ambassador Edelman, great to be back with you. I'll add my 1 cent to that. I learned a lot of lessons traveling to the White House with Ambassador Edelman. And I would just point out one funny moment that if you've ever been in Ambassador Edelman's office, you understand that he is a man immensely organized in his head, but sometimes the office doesn't reflect that.
That is a fair statement. I think mostly what you learned driving to the White House with me was how we could run red lights and get away with it in Washington, D.C. But Phil, really, it's great to have you. And I wanted to start out because of your knowledge and expertise with NATO and European security. And I know you follow, as Elliot and I do, very closely what's going on in Ukraine. What is your sense of the current state of play? You see all these reports about the Russians building up their forces, building up armored forces, 40,000 troops to launch some kind of offensive in the sort of Kupiansk direction. What's your sense of where we are right now?
So I think there are legitimate indications that Russia has aspirations of another offensive. I think there are also some pretty good indications that they have run into a buzzsaw in the last month and a half and have suffered an attritional toll that is staggering. So I do believe there is more that they can call on. I do not expect that these would be the very best trained and most capable troops, but they certainly will probably once again bring mass to the battlefield. And I don't know how far you want to go down this hole, but as we listen to what Ukraine is talking about, they are talking about moving to this sort of active intelligent defense. They have numerous words they use, but it is a posture on the ground. And we need to talk about the sea and the air, but it is a posture on the ground that would better place them if Russia launches another buzzsaw. I mean, we've watched Avdiivka, we've watched Bakhmut, we've watched several places where the Russians have thrown wave after wave of less capable fighters on the battlefield. And if that's any indication of what the next one will be like, I think the Ukrainians are happy to take this new posture. I think in their minds, they really want to be on the offense. And I think that maybe they will think beyond what happens in this next period where they'll be more defensive. But Russia has suffered quite the loss. Ukraine has taken some losses too, more manageable numbers. But if you would allow me just one moment to say that while Ukraine did come to a slower place in its advance on the ground, they did get on the left side, or as you Americans would call it, the east side of the river, in a couple of places. But they, you know, their ground advance has largely now become positional and is transferring to this defensive mode. But we should acknowledge that without a single capital asset, I believe that Ukraine is it's a tough word, but may actually be winning the fight for the Northern Black Sea. We see Russia repositioning assets much further in the rear. We see assets that will never move from the piers. They are so severely damaged. The Russians have turned the damaged side against the pier so you can't see it. But the fact of the matter is some of those ships that are in Ukraine are in Crimea now are static displays, and they will be for a long time. So I think that they have made real measurable successes in the Black Sea. The story of the air is a little different. Russia is doing a lot of damage with these long-range missiles and long-range drones. They are largely now Iranian or North Korean kit, some Russian kit clearly still. But Russia's still doing a lot of damage with those. But that is the sum total right now of their real capability from the sky. The highly vaunted, you and I used to worry about Russian Air Force has failed, I think, the country in Ukraine. On the flip side, the Ukrainians started with a very meager air force, and they have lost a lot of them. But may I just say that I think they fought well and smart with what they had. And now the real innovation that's happening in the air war in Ukraine is truly what the Ukrainians are doing with smaller, closer drones. First-person video, you hear that term a lot now. The Ukrainians are honestly wreaking havoc along the frontline trace of troops with this kit. And then in the bigger sense, some of their long-range drones, to include those at sea, are really beginning to give Ukraine some reach. So yes, we have to say that the Ukrainian offensive came to a halt. I don't like to use the word failed because of the toll they exacted from Russia, but the air and sea piece has gone, I would think, pretty well for Ukraine.
Yeah, I think people throw the word stalemate around in part, I think, because General Zaluzhny, of course, kind of called it a stalemate in his Economist essay a couple of months ago. And I think that, you know, sort of got this notion going. But as you say, the battlefield is actually more complex, and the attrition that the Ukrainians are wreaking on both men and materiel on the Russian side is pretty, as you were saying, astounding. You know, around Avdiivka, what I think you see over the last couple of weeks, tell me if you disagree, but you do see the Russians making some very small gains. But as you were saying, with these astronomical costs attached to them. So, you know, there's movement, but it's, you know, movement of, you know, one or two tree lines at a time. Literally, it's like 100 meters, 200 meters. But the cost is just, you know, so enormous that it does raise the question of, even if they launch an offensive, and even as they appear to, at least for the moment, have a considerable artillery advantage, you see numbers thrown around like 5-1, they still have trouble, you know, moving forward, in part because of what you were saying about the FPV drones and things like that. Am I wrong there?
No, you are, I think you're exactly right. May I offer a thought? You know, people are beginning now to ask, what are the Russians doing? Because to launch another massive offensive would be, I think, truly a bridge too far. But may I offer what is becoming in a thought for me and one or two others? And that is, I think that Mr. Putin and Russia are beginning to realize that if Western support begins to drift in the wrong direction, and Ukraine has to come to the table, or the world begins to force them to come to the table. If you looked at Russia's frontline trace right now, it's unmanageable for the long term because of the dents and curves in that frontline trace. Either side could place artillery that would hold huge swaths of the other at bay and at risk. And so I don't know this. This is Phil Breedlove and one or two of my best friends thinking about this. I believe they're beginning to think about how to move that line, that frontline trace, to put it into a place that is manageable for the long term, because they expect that the West is going to put Ukraine in a position where they have to give away more land to get peace. And Russia wants a frontline trace that is something that is militarily manageable in the out years. Does that make any sense at all?
I think it does. I also think there's a political calculation here, which is the Russian election is coming up in March. I was just reading in the Financial Times before we got on the air that the Central Election Commission is now going to apparently disqualify Mr. Boris Nadezhdin, the opposition candidate whose unlikely and somewhat hapless candidacy was generating actually a lot of public enthusiasm. So go figure. It turns out that he doesn't have enough signatures to get on the ballot, despite, you know, photo evidence of people queuing up for, you know, for hours to sign up for his petition. So I think there may be an element here as well of Putin wanting a battlefield victory before the election. You know, I think that may be at work as well. I want to kind of plumb your expertise, you know, not only as a former SACUR, but as a former vice chief of staff of the Air Force, because there's been a lot of debate about the air piece of this. As you say, the Russian Air Force has actually not performed as one might have expected, given the advantages that they had when the war kicked off. My surmise is that they're less formidable than they look, first of all, because they haven't had a lot of flying time. You know, they're not, you know, not that proficient, that they thought they would be able to eliminate Ukraine's air defenses, but the Ukrainians were actually very crafty about hiding and disguising those air defenses in the first few days of the war, and therefore being able to actually hold the Russians at bay. I mean, what you see the Russians doing is basically flying in Russian airspace and firing standoff weapons.
Exactly.
At Ukraine. And so the question is, you know, would F-16s have made a difference? You know, there's a blame game that's been going on. Some of our former colleagues in the Pentagon, I've heard it from them. You know, none of it would have made a difference. Wouldn't have made a difference if we gave them HIMARS earlier. Wouldn't have made a difference if we gave them more of the cluster attackums. Wouldn't have made a difference if we gave them unitary warhead, long range attackums. Wouldn't have made a difference if we gave them F-16. Is that, what's your sense of that? My sense is that's blame shifting and, you know.
I'm in violent disagreement with almost every one of those things you said. Let's give some real credit due to Jim Stavridis before me. He started something that my headquarters finished. He long before the first attacks in 14, Jim started a study of what it would take to bring the Ukrainian military into sort of more NATO compliance and make them a more Western group. And frankly, sir, in 14, we already knew most of what we're talking about now, what they need to be able to fight modern maneuver warfare, et cetera, et cetera. And we identified way back then, not F-16s, you know, as a SACUR, I couldn't try to sell American kit. I said they needed 4-plus generation aircraft that can be multi-role and do air defense until it's not required and then roll into supporting the Army. And I will tell you that if we had started in 14 training and putting them into some fourth generation airplane, you know, I love the F-16, having flown it for 24 years. If we had put them into an aircraft and they had arrived at the beginning of this war with a squadron or two of very capable F-16 pilots and F-16s, it would have made a difference. There's a few things in this world I know a little bit about, and that's one of them. And frankly, it's the same thing. We identified their long-range artillery problems. We identified that they needed a better surface-to-air defense, but what we worked with them over the years is how to better use theirs, calling it the shell game. The Russians bombed a lot of spots that had nothing sitting on it because they had moved right before the war started. They started the shell game with the assets they had. So I couldn't disagree more. If we had just looked at what we already knew they had, and we had worked on it, those things for the 10 years here between these wars, it would have made a difference. They're entitled to their opinion. I'm entitled to mine, and I think that it would have made a difference. May I just say one more thing about the Russians? So we, you know, two things, and you mentioned them both, so I'm just going to pile on your remarks. The Russians like to show the world their capability by buying shiny new kit. And they have some fairly good shiny new kit. They don't have them in numbers, but they have some pretty good shiny new kit. And you said it, they're not flying it enough to be proficient in it. And then the second thing, at the beginning of the war, we in the West, the first thing we think about is suppression of enemy air defenses, so that we can begin to build and gain and maintain first local battlefield air superiority and then grow that into larger air superiority, or in two or three of our wars to air supremacy at some point. And what we saw at the beginning of this war is Russia is 100% completely incapable of doing SEED, suppression of enemy air defenses. And a small, relatively unsophisticated Ukrainian network enabled by our intelligence, let's be clear about that, they were able to do this game and held a much superior, quote unquote, much superior air force at bay. And so we need to remember those lessons. We are already beginning to narrow down the flying time for our pilots. We need to think about what that meant to Russia. And we need to remember that these old axioms were earned in blood, and we've got to be able to do SEED. We have to project air power over our forces, and that takes knocking down their defenses. I think Russia failed at both.
Yeah, I know. I agree with you totally. And I found myself, when I heard some of this, you know, discussion from my colleagues, bristling a bit, because, you know, the failure, if you want to call it that, the inability of the Ukrainians to break through these tiered, layered defenses, which in part because of our delays in the West of getting equipment to the Ukrainians and training them, you know, we were in some sense responsible for that. And we were asking them to do something, you know, combined arms warfare, concentrated at a key point to break through and then divide the Russian forces down in the land bridge there between, you know, Mariupol and Crimea, that we would never have done without, you know, air superiority. Exactly. Or air supremacy.
Exactly. This I had this discussion with a correspondent just 2 days ago. They were talking about how, well, it seems we wasted money teaching the Ukrainians how to do modern maneuver warfare, and because they failed. And I said, they didn't fail, we failed. Let me tell you, just like you laid out, in our services, the first thing we do is intelligence preparation of the battlefield, and then we begin a campaign of suppression of enemy air defenses to establish battlefield air superiority. And everything in modern maneuver warfare relies on that. Think back, ask someone sometimes, do you remember how much stuff we piled up in the desert south of Kuwait before we went into Kuwait? Could we have done that if the Iraqi Air Force could have bombed it? Not only no, but you know what? No, you know? And so we did an extraordinary logistics buildup because we had air supremacy by that time. And we knew that we could store in the open all this kit to go forward. Everything we do in the West starts first with air superiority over our troops.
As we're having this discussion, the Congress is considering a supplemental bill to provide a couple of things: additional aid to Ukraine, some additional aid to our Israeli friends as they are pursuing a destruction of Hamas in Gaza, and some additional defense capability in the Indo-Pacific as well as part of this, all wrapped up together with an effort to strengthen the security of our own border in the South, which is obviously a very big issue and a very real issue. Right now, the prospects for the supplemental don't look great. We've got the House of Representatives saying that they won't even take the bill up, that it's dead on arrival, as the Speaker has said. He said it was the bill that actually emerged from all these negotiations was worse than he anticipated, although I don't know how it could have been worse, because he said it was going to be dead on arrival before it even emerged. Anyway, I don't want to drag you into the political thicket, but if this assistance doesn't get passed, I mean, I noticed one of the things in the bill is a big chunk of money to help the Department of Defense get production of 155 artillery rounds up to the 100,000 level that Bill LaPlante, the Undersecretary for Acquisition, is trying to get it to with our defense industry partners. That's, of course, you know, one way to help solve this problem of the imbalance between Russian and Ukrainian artillery ammunition magazines and the depth thereof. Without this supplemental, what is your sense of what the impact will be on the battlefield we've just been discussing?
So I'd like to start the answer with a 20-second vignette, and that is that I'm often asked, how is this war going to end? And my answer has surprised some and has, I wouldn't say infuriated, but made some angry, because I say it every time. And that is, this war is going to end exactly like Western policymakers want it to end. Western policy will drive the end of this war. If we withdraw the funding from Ukraine, Ukraine will fight valiantly, Tens of thousands of Ukrainians will die, and Russia will subjugate Ukraine. If we do nothing different than we're doing now, and this is very critical, I'm not being critical of a person, but I'm being critical of a policy. I believe our policy right now is to give Ukraine enough to remain viable on the battlefield, but not enough to win. Our nation's leaders right now, I believe, are incapable of mentally dealing with a defeated Russia or a defeated Putin and what that might entail. And so we have self-deterred, and we are not giving Ukraine what it needs to win. So if we stay in this position, over time, Ukraine will come to a culminating point, or the West will tire and stop supplying, and you get the same result as number one. Russia will win and subjugate the rest of Ukraine. Now, my third one is bold, but I believe it. And that is, if we give Ukraine what they need to win, they'll win. And people ask me, okay, well, what is it? And they want a silver bullet. It's the F-16, or it's this, or it's that. And I basically answer the same way every time now. If you give Ukraine what the United States of America would take to the battlefield if this was our fight, give them that, they will win. You know, airplanes and SAMs to establish battlefield air superiority, long-range strike, and the policy to strike Russia before it can bring all this kit to bear. That's one of the big problems that you didn't mention a minute ago when, you know, Russia's got all this stuff that they're piled up for this offensive, they say, and it's sitting there. And we forbid Ukraine from shooting in there with our kit to destroy it. We would be striking that before it came across the border. We would be striking it on all the lines of communications, and we forbid Ukraine from doing that. So I just say one more time, this war will end exactly how Western policymakers decide it will end. And in the short term, to your question, if we begin now to pull down that support, the first impact is on the soldiers on the battlefield of Ukraine. They're looking up for their cover, okay? And they start to see it erode. Now, I applaud the EU for its promise to support, I think it was 50 billion euro. This is good, but if the United States starts pulling back, donors from around the world will start to pull back. And then, as I said, we end up with option one, as I described it before. This is not a good place to be. We need to sort this out. You talk to people on the Hill. I won't use any names, but they, you know, they say, hey, this is a tool. Right now, we're using this tool to get change on the border. Once we get the change on the border, we'll get back to business. Well, the question is, how long does that take? And what is the impact on Ukraine in the meantime? And that's something that I think history may judge us harshly for.
Yeah, I quite agree. One of the things that has inhibited the Biden administration from providing as much stuff as soon as it was needed and titrating out, you know, this assistance in small dribs and drabs. I mean, one example of that is the when we finally gave the Ukrainians a few months ago, you know, some cluster munitions variant of the ATACMS missile, not the long range right. one, but the shorter range one with the cluster munitions. Those munitions were used very effectively by the Ukrainians to kill a lot of Ka-52 helicopters, which had been one of the rotary wing assets the Russians had used to help thwart the land advance by the Ukrainians in the south in Zaporizhia. So, you know, shame on us, I think, for having done that. I mean, by the way, most, I've said this on the podcast before, but most of those cluster variant of the ATACMS violate the U.S. policy for cluster munitions. They've got a dud rate of over 3%. So the odds that we would actually use them, we would have to be really in extremis.
I don't think we would have ever used those things.
So, you know, it'll cost us more to demilitarize them than it will to send them to the Ukrainians. And so it drives me crazy. But
and I'm told, sir, that we have almost 1,000 rounds of the very first batches of the high explosive unitary warhead that you described that we're going to end up demilling. And why aren't we giving those to Ukraine?
Those are going to be, by the way, replaced by the PrSM missile, which is in development now soon anyway. So it wouldn't be giving away any qualitative U.S. military advantage. But to your point earlier, General Breedlove, about the hesitation to provide Ukraine with the ability to strike along its own border inside Russia, where Russia is staging a military equipment and munitions in order to attack Ukraine. The Ukrainians have been, you know, essentially forbidden to use our kit to do that. I think the argument, I think it's wrongheaded, but it's an escalation management argument, which is if we give them kit they strike Russian territory with, that will allow Putin to say, you know, that he's at war with NATO rather than with Ukraine. But if you watch Russian television and if you listen to what Putin says, they're already, and what Shoigu and Gerasimov, when he was appearing on TV, although he hasn't appeared for about a month, I'm not sure where he is, but if you listen to that, they're all saying that they're at war with NATO anyway.
Exactly.
So, I don't see, frankly, what the benefit is of holding back. I could see that you would say, don't hit Moscow, don't hit, you know, downtown St. Petersburg, but why you would, you know, be so concerned about this, particularly given the fact that at each turn, we were told that, you know, providing M1 Abrams tanks would be a red line for Russia. We were told that providing them with long-range artillery, the HIMARS system, would be a red line for Russia. We're told F-16s would be a red line for Russia. All these things have been given to Ukraine, and you know, nothing has changed in terms of the fight. So, am I wrong to think that this is a pretext rather than a real reason?
I'm with you, and I would also add a couple other lines of logic here. When we have given them some of these newer weapons, we gave them strict instructions about what not to do with them. They have been incredibly compliant. They know they can't bite the hand that feeds. I think we've had one U.S. Humvee drive in up there in Belarus and was a part of an attack up there, and then we got that sorted out. But to the largest, almost 100%, case, the Ukrainians have followed the restrictions that we've given them with these missiles. But I think it's just preposterous. I tell people all the time, if, you know, Secretary Austin, as you remember, was my peer when I was the SACUR, he was a CENTCOM commander. And if we'd have told General Lloyd Austin that he is going to have to deal with strikes from his enemy coming from nearly 300 degrees around into the CENTCOM AOR, but he couldn't shoot back at them with his long-range artillery, his head would have exploded, okay? And that's what we've told Ukraine. You are Roger Federer, and you're going to receive serve for the entire French Open because we're not going to allow you to serve back. And this is preposterous. And so I think that developing a policy under which Ukraine could use these weapons and the types of targets they could strike, you would see just the same discipline that they used in firing these cluster ATACMs, the short-range ATACMs. I just really have a hard time here. I think, again, we have self-deterred in the options that would give Ukraine the ability to do significant damage because we're afraid of what that significant damage would mean in a policy sense.
You mentioned the European assistance, and I agree with you. I'm you know, very grateful to our European colleagues, first of all, for getting around the blockage that the Hungarians under Orban had imposed on assistance from the EU. They seem to have, you know, navigated that particular challenge. But, you know, we were talking earlier about the difficulty Bill LaPlante is having getting the U.S. defense industrial base to the point where it can produce 100,000 rounds a month. You know, the Ukrainians were firing 6,000 a day back in the summer when they had a steady, you know, flow of munitions. The Europeans have promised a million rounds of ammunition, but they're way behind, in part because their defense industrial base is in even worse shape than ours and suffering from even longer decades of neglect than ours has been. What do you think the, you know, assuming we don't get the supplemental, what is your judgment about the degree to which Europeans can step up and fill the gap? I mean, you said rightly, in my view, that if we don't, you know, if we're not going to do this, ultimately there will be a decline in European support. I do think there could be an initial effort by the Europeans to fill the gap, but yes. What's your sense of how well they will be able to do it?
So I think there's good news and there's bad news here. The good news is that I believe we've seen a true and I believe somewhat lasting change of heart, change of approach by the Europeans. I don't know if you've seen the charts, but in a per capita by GDP basis, we're like 14th on the list of donors these days. And I believe now that the sum total of Europe is now eclipsed U.S. giving. So we're seeing a changing here that is good. But that industrial piece, there are actually some nations who have a little bit more of a command connection between their government and their national companies, such that they're a little quicker to react than we are in our paradigm in the United States. And even in there, we're seeing some goodness. But the scale that Europe can offer right now is not going to answer the call. Frankly, the scale in America is not going to answer the call until we figure out how to build excess capacity under the current FARs and so forth. We've got a ways to go as well. So while I am happy as to the change of direction of the Europeans, I'm not sanguine that they're going to be able to create the capacity. We would have a problem creating the same capacities.
Yeah, the FARs being the Federal Acquisition Regulations.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to let our listeners, you know what we're talking about. But yeah, I mean, those are regulations and those are processes and procedures that are, you know, finely tuned for, you know, producing military goods in peacetime. But, you know, we're a nation right now with, you know, with associated friends who are fighting two active wars. So, and we're staring at the prospect of a third, which might involve us directly in the Indo-Pacific. And so the idea that we can just continue to meander along under these sort of, you know, peacetime processes, I think is...
And if I could, I think we need to learn a lesson for the future. And that is we have a system now that will literally punish a manufacturer if they use money from a contract to create excess capacity. And that all happened for reasons that we know. You know, there are some guys that did bad things in the past, and we created these FARs and others that closely control that. We have to go back and rethink, how do we incentivize industry to create and maintain a certain amount of excess capacity? And sometimes it's not about the assembly line. It's about the people, the skilled labor that work on the assembly line. And so I just throw out there that I think when we get around to the lessons learned of this period we're in now, we have got to rethink what we do in our military, industrial, governmental arrangements so that we are not flat-footed the next time we need it.
Yeah, if you talk to anybody in industry, they will tell you, you know, basically two things. One is they need to be able to have some sense that before they expand the physical plant to produce these things, that there's going to be a steady demand signal, because they don't want to invest a lot of money pouring concrete and building facilities and then get told, oh yeah, well, this was just a 1-year supplemental. And after that, you know, that's the end of the road. And the other is what you were pointing to, General Breedlove, which is a big, big obstacle, probably the longest pole in the tent for industry, which is bringing on the skilled labor. I mean, we have a shortage of, you know, welders and electricians. And oh, by the way, there is in this supplemental legislation, there is money to help build up our submarine industrial base so that we can actually meet the obligations we've undertaken under AUKUS to, you know, help our Australian and UK allies out. But I wonder if we could turn for a moment from your, you know, perspective as a former Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. What do you see as the potential consequences going forward of defeat? I mean, you said in the long run, if we don't step up, you know, Russia will end up dominating Ukraine. What are the consequences for European security? And what do you see as the knock-on consequences more broadly in the rest of the world?
So this is a very complicated problem. And I'm going to say part of the problem starts in that I do not believe that our current leadership in Washington has explained to America why Ukraine counts, why it's important that Ukraine is a functioning part of society into the future. Most, you know, I love our country. I come from a place we call the Redneck Riviera. You know, we got a lot of people out there that couldn't put their finger on Crimea on a map and don't understand the contributions of Ukraine to the world. Some got a taste of it when the grain supply slowed down, with what happened to the food supplies and the cost of things started going up big time. Oh my God, I didn't realize Ukraine had such an impact. Very few people understand that almost every medium Earth orbit or high Earth orbit or moonshot we did for several decades flew on Ukrainian rocket motors. And so there is all manner of things that people don't understand, that Ukraine is a highly technical, functioning part of the European economy. The European economy is still almost 50% of our GDP. Their economy is important to us. And isolationism is not going to fix that problem. We have to remain connected. And so we have to start off by explaining to Americans why Ukraine counts. And for all those reasons, if Ukraine goes back to Russia, So how fast do you think rebuilding in Ukraine is going to happen if Russia is running the show? How fast do you think all those hundreds of thousands of mines that Russia has put into the field will come out? They salted large swaths of agricultural land. There are mines all over the battlefields and the shaping of the battlefields out there. And even if the whole Western world focuses on that, it's going to take a long time. But with the economy Russia has and its capability now, how fast is that going to happen? Are they going to build a BRICS community that's going to come in and invest in Ukraine and pick up the mines and so forth? So, you know, a defeat to me means a loss of an important industrial partner, a loss of an incredible agricultural partner, and frankly, for a military person, a loss of a geostrategic important part of the world in how Europe defends itself into the future. Sir, I know you read those two articles that Mr. Putin gave us to sign. I think he actually called them treaties at the beginning of the war, about 8 or 9 days before the war started. If you read those papers, it is very clear that Ukraine is the start of this campaign. It is much bigger than in Ukraine. And I don't know if you agree with me or not, but the gray zone battle going on in Georgia right now is pretty evident what Russia is trying to do. And I recently spent time with the foreign minister of Moldova, and what's going on in that country is pretty straightforward. So Ukraine is not only, it's bigger than Ukraine, but it's already functioning in a non-kinetic way in two other countries. And so in the future, without Ukraine as a part of a bulwark, whether it's in EU and NATO or not, if it is Russian, it's a big problem in that sense. So I think they're literally all three of those venues is a loss of Ukraine is a huge problem.
No, I completely agree. If you go back and look at those documents that Sergei Lavrov gave to Tony Blinken, they basically call for a rollback of all of NATO enlargement going back to 1997.
Exactly.
And creating essentially a privileged sphere of influence for Russia in Central and Eastern Europe. And one thing that worries me is that I don't think Americans appreciate that as much as you and I have discussed the losses Russia has taken, and they've been really quite astonishing in terms of 300,000 casualties. I think you and I would have said, okay, that Russians will say basta, we've had enough at that point. But what is striking to me is that Putin has been successful in putting Russia's economy on a completely war footing, 24/7, three shifts a day of defense production. The budget's now 40% devoted to defense. It's producing a lot of stuff. I mean, it's not, great quality stuff. It's not, notwithstanding what Putin said recently about how great Russian stuff is. I mean, it's not as good as our stuff, but it's sufficient, to the task. And, if they're dealing with something that is less challenging than biting off a kind of 1,000-mile front in Ukraine, which is, as you were saying earlier, has stretched Russian forces very thin. By the way, we had an Australian historian, David Stahl, who has written a number of histories of the Eastern Front. Had the Russians actually gone back and studied their own military history, they might have realized they were putting themselves in the same position the Wehrmacht was in when it invaded the Soviet Union in 1941. But be that as it may, I worry that if you get them concentrating their forces in the Baltic, say, where they have interior lines of communication, where they have potentially, some fifth column assets they could draw on, where they can concentrate their forces in places that are very geographically compact, unlike Ukraine, that in 4 or 5 years, they can, reconstitute and provide a very, very serious threat to our, NATO treaty allies. And then we'll really be up against the escalation dynamic, because we'll be wrestling with an Article 5 situation. I don't know if you agree with that.
No, but I do. I kind of also add to that, line of thought, that war is not a business. Okay. It's not a business. But if we examine our investment to date, most people say about 4.5% of 1 year of DoD budget, and the impact that the Ukrainians have made on the Russian military for that investment, it's staggering. But none of that obviates what you talked about, which is Russia can still, as you Germany, you got to love it, interior lines, they still are set to be able to rapidly assemble force, even if they are secondary level forces and lesser trained. Mass has its own beauty, doesn't it? Especially against a Baltic target. And so they are not out of the game, no matter how badly they've been hammered during this war so far. And it bears us, I fear that at some point here, people feel that Ukraine will have to go to the table, give away more Ukrainian lives and more Ukrainian land for our safety. And then we all get back to how do we enjoy our peace dividends, slow down all this concern. We need to be very laser focused on there is a lot of work that remains to be done by the problems that have been exposed by this conflict. And if we don't have a commission or someone or NATO or EU that is focused on, we got a punch list now that cannot be dropped because we've stopped, quote unquote, the conflict. And I would ask you if you really believe if we stopped this month, if that's the last time Russia goes across a line in Ukraine.
We will be hearing from our Russian friends again, I'm afraid. It's the lesson I've drawn from all of this. We have just a few minutes, General Breedlove, before we wrap up. And I do want to ask you if you would, you know, maybe share some thoughts with us. Israel used to be in the SACUR's area of responsibility. It's now been transferred over to CENTCOM, which probably makes a little bit more sense. But you know the Israeli military, you know the IDF, you know the commanders, you know, and you know what they're up against because you spent a lot of your career, as I did mine, in the post 9/11 wars against terrorist organizations like Hamas. What's your sense of how it's going? I mean, this has been Elliot was in Israel a couple of months ago and reported back to our listeners about the incredible trauma that Israeli society suffered on October 7th, the equivalent of roughly about if it were as if 40,000 Americans had been killed on 9/11 rather than 3,000. What's your sense of how it's going and how do you think that conflict ends?
This is probably the worst conundrum that the leadership of Israel has ever faced. You know the very senior leadership better than I, but Benny Gantz and those guys who I worked with, I know them as extremely well. And I can't imagine facing what they're facing, which is they've got a real enemy that they've got to deal with. And that real enemy has lashed out at them and proven that they can still completely upend security inside of Israel. And so they've got that problem to deal with. But the other side of the coin is that the world is moving to a position where Israel will begin to lose support, I think, in a drastic way if they, and I will just use the pronoun we, don't find a better solution fast. And so I just one more minute of preparation for the story. I remember the first time I was taken up on the Golan Heights and looked at the problem through that huge telescope, you know, they got up there at OP1. And I remember the first time I flew my F-16 over the Dead Sea. And I'm looking at Jordan and I'm looking at the coastline. And I really began to understand what Israel calls a lack of strategic depth. Their strategic issue is more acute than I think any country in the world when it comes to geography. And so, this is all to prepare you for what I think is tough words, but I believe Israel's got to be allowed to eliminate the issue. But I think it needs to happen quickly because right now in the grand scheme of things, the damage that is being done to Israel in the eyes of the world is going to be a real problem in the future.
Hard to disagree with that. I'm delighted to have had General Phil Breedlove as our special guest today on Shield of the Republic. We didn't even get to the Indo-Pacific, General Breedlove, but there's a lot going on in the world. And so I hope we can have you back, hopefully have you back when Elliot is, you know, not touristing around some of the nicer, you know, garden spots of Europe. Thank you for joining us today on Shield of the Republic.
Great to be on with you again, sir.